Hello, everyone, and welcome to this presentation on Vimala Thakur for Great Awakenings. My name is Amy Edelstein, and I'm here with my colleague and co-teacher and good friend, Chris Parrish. Vimala Thakur was an Indian spiritual teacher, was born in the early 20s and died fairly recently in 2009. She's an extraordinary figure, a deep, deep individual with a powerfully independent, illuminated understanding and an unusual, extraordinary capacity to work directly with people and to inspire people to engage themselves in a life of radical inquiry. She really advocated and was about a total revolution of the mind. And her depth and subtlety of distinctions and ability to access silence beyond the mind helped her communicate in extraordinarily fresh and uncontrived ways about that which is most subtle and how that relates to human relationships, human engagement in the world, political activism, environmental responsibility, care for the poor, spiritual practice, everything from diet and exercise to a relationship to nature was all part of this holistic vision and life that she lived and exemplified. We're going to take you through her unusual life story in a few minutes, but what I want to express to you is how deeply I respect Vimala Thakur as an individual, as a spiritual teacher, and as probably one of the most original and deep spiritual expressions that I've come across. I had the good fortune to meet her in the late 90s or early 2000, and she struck me with her presence and her passion and her depth. What was most unusual about being with her is the way she listened. She took everything that was said so seriously. It was like when she listened, she opened her entire being. And you sort of felt like you were speaking to her into this huge expanse of emptiness and clarity, so that everything you said resounded like a bell in the night, just clear and ringing. And she listened and took it in and responded with the fullness of her experience and the fullness of herself. She gave the impression of being as large as a mountain, you know, as solid and vast and towering as one of the Himalayan peaks, and you were sitting with her at base camp way below. And when she'd stand up, she wasn't even 5 feet tall. She was a tiny woman. And she wasn't, it was her inner height and breadth and depth that gave the impression of her being such a vast heart. I found reading her again recently to be a real surprise, because as much as I've always respected her and cherished the memories of her, engaging with her again, I felt like I need to spend more time with the works of this woman. I need to spend more time just sitting in stillness and reflecting and contemplating, because she's pointing to really a radical revolution of seeing, a radical revolution of relationship to the world, a radical revolution to our ideas of wholeness, a radical revolution in our ideas of development. So that's by way of introduction, and I'm going to turn it over to Chris to add your own wonder and respect and thoughts.
Yes, definitely, because I also had the very good fortune, like Amy, to meet Vimala Thakur. I first saw her in London in the 1970s, and considerably later, when I was in India, I sought her out and spent time with her in the 1990s. And she is extraordinary, or was extraordinarily impressive, and I feel I've learned a lot from her. But also, I think revisiting her work now, years later, I realized that I didn't even half appreciate how much she has to offer. What an extraordinarily unusual figure she is. And she's not a fraction as well known as she ought to be, given what she had to offer, because she had no interest at all in publicity or interviews or marketing in any way. She didn't want to be photographed. She said, "I'm socially dead." She just had no interest in all of that. She was interested in people, in society, in bringing about change. She had there was no self-promoting motive at all in her. And yet she was one of the most holistic figures I know of. I mean, a rare unity or integration of inner and outer. And we'll go into this more as we describe her teaching. I mean, she was a mystic, yet very precise and rational, and simultaneously a very powerful and effective social activist. And although you may not have read interviews or seen her books, which weren't really widely distributed, she spent decades traveling around the world, I think in about 35 different countries. And so although she didn't write books as such, she didn't sit down and write books, many of the talks she's given have been turned into books. So we had a rich resource to choose from, and so for this particular Great Awakenings, we've selected Blossoms of Friendship, and this is a collection of talks given by Vimala in 1973 in the place where she spent most of her time, was Mount Abu in India. And it's a real gem of a small book, and it really sums up her thought. I mean, it's hard to pick one among many. It's a collection of a series of talks she gave in Mount Abu back then. And it's not the sort of book you can just pick and sort of skim through and read. You can't read too much of it. I wouldn't call it dense, because she writes in very ordinary language, but it's very deep and very subtle. And she, in this little book, and this is just one part of what she taught, it covers very subtle distinctions between things such as awareness, attention, concentration, meditation, silence, and it touches on a lot of other subjects as well. So it's a sort of book, to have on the bedside table. You could read a paragraph or two, and I find it extraordinary. So she is a very unusual figure, truly independent, and especially so if you think of an Indian woman born in 1921. And when Amy and I were talking about her prior to this talk, I think both of us were feeling that of all the mystics we've been studying, she's perhaps the one that we are feeling we can learn the most from, which we'll explain more, because she went so deeply both into the workings of the mind and the nature of a mystical experience and the non-dual, and in a way how to engage with an active life, because she wasn't a recluse, she wasn't a hermit. That's what's so unusual about her. She's a really totally rounded figure. She's a great, I mean, we asked why we picked Vimala. Well, she was a great enlightened revolutionary and activist, who really did bring about a very independent approach to spirituality And she was one, I think, very responsible for bringing the wisdom of the East to the modern world without, in a way, like Krishnamurti, who she was associated with, but in a broader way. And again, like him, endeavoring to awaken people through rational inquiry. But also, she wasn't one to dismiss teachings or spiritual practice. She wasn't, as you know, Krishnamurti was more at the radical end of that spectrum. With Vimala, she seemed to bring everything together. So I think this is why we feel she's incredibly relevant to all of us. And what it's hard to say what she taught, because she wanted to wake people up to what she called the totality of life, which is no small thing. So a great figure. And maybe you'd like to continue about on this, Amy.
Sure. Where to begin with her? I mean, she was an unusual child, very, very thoughtful, and also very incredibly strong-willed and very precocious. Now, when she was born in the 20s, Indian women were not given the same type of spiritual education that boys were. Indian girls were not sent to study the Vedas and, you know, more esoteric philosophy with great teachers. The boys were allowed to do that. And from the time she was five, she asked her father if she could study the classical spiritual teachings and philosophies. He must have been a very unusual and free-thinking person, because he really supported the thirst for knowledge in his daughter. He took her to some of the best Vedanta teachers of the time and allowed her to study as much as she wanted, allowed her to really get the philosophical background that she was so passionately interested in. He permitted her to study under one condition, and that condition was that she not take any of her instructors, however greatly they were revered, as the penultimate decider of truth, but that she investigate for herself and that she always think independently. So he instilled that in that search for truth and the independent nature of that, the autonomous relationship with spiritual discovery in her from a very young age. And then aside from that, he really gave her freedom to study. She did intensive meditation practice. At one point in her late teens, she went to the foothills of the Himalayas and spent time in complete solitude in a cave. Again, very, very unusual for a young woman at that time, and also of her upbringing. She was, you know, from an educated family. She took full advantage of the education and the intellectual freedom and really poured herself into it. She also went to college and studied Indian philosophy. At the same time, she was always an independent thinker, and she was putting together the ancient myths and morals and fables that are all part of the Indian pantheon with the complex philosophical teachings, with Vedanta, and with Western philosophy, and with social conditions. She was always also interested in the cultural history and development around her. So her education was deeply spiritual and also very broad. She was in some ways, you know, a true liberal arts thinker who developed her ability to think by engaging with the broad context of rather than simply the particulars. Chris, do you want to pick up from here?
Yeah, her life does read like an epic Indian tale, like something out of the Mahabharata, but it's extraordinary, like because she was unusually from, you know, as Amy's saying, from a child, very unusually precocious, you know, even apparently, you know, she wanted to know who God was, and her grandmother told her, well, God lived in the forest, so she ran away to the forest to find God, and she, you know, she's very independent in her practicing alone in caves after she'd done her degree. She did the master's in philosophy, but she was already doing retreats when she was aged 12, and then a later teenager she did long retreats living alone in a cave in the Himalayas, really exploring meditation and for herself, and going to see great teachers and pundits, and wanting to learn the as well as Western philosophy, to learn all about her own native Indian tradition. And you know, it's quite difficult because women weren't allowed to be taught that, so she had to often study herself, because she had, you know, it was quite a hardship there, because it was you know, it was very traditional at the time she was going to college and wanting to seek learning in the 1930s and 40s, and yet she was completely undaunted in spite of, you know, she says it did hurt her very much. And then as a young woman, she became a leading figure in this Gandhian-inspired land redistribution movement of Vinoba Bhave, and she walked with him. They in this movement, they just walked by foot throughout India from village to village, lecturing and exhorting and encouraging wealthy landowners to give some of their land to desperately poor and landless farm workers. And, you know, extraordinary work that she did there. And it was while she was on this extended traveling and talking, you know, throughout the villages, it was in 1956 that she was invited to hear several discourses by the legendary Indian spiritual teacher J. Krishnamurti, who we covered in an earlier Great Awakenings. And this was a pivotal point in her life. She listened to him, and later then she met him personally. And that really brought about an explosion, and what for her was a irrevocable transformation in her being. And she, according to her, this is how she put it, that it left her feeling consumed by an uncontrollable awareness and an intense flame of passion. She said, this is her actual words, she said at that moment, something within has been let loose. It cannot stand any frontiers. The invasion of a new awareness, irresistible and uncontrollable, has swept away everything. And Krishnamurti recognized her awakening, and he begged her to go out and speak widely, which is, if you know Krishnamurti, it's not something, I mean, I've never heard in all his many decades of teaching, I never knew he urge anyone else to do that in the half a century of teaching. And, you know, he said to her that this is chronicled. She wrote a little book about her time of a short sort of autobiographical book of this period of her life and her awakening and a time with Krishnamurti called On an Eternal Voyage, a very beautiful little book. And a PDF available of that. So it's very short. So Krishnamurti said to her, why don't you explode? Why don't you put bombs under all those old people who followed a wrong line? Shout from the housetops. Go out and set them on fire. There's none who's doing this, not even one. What are you waiting for? So this really got to her, because she was in she didn't know what to do, and she, and also it's a bit complicated because she'd had some terrible ear disease and pain, and that she thought she was going to die. She was in such pain, and seemed this ear infection was so bad, and it didn't seem to be able to be treated. And Krishnamurti offered to heal her, when, or to try to heal her. He said apparently he'd always had some ability to heal with his hands by laying on his hands. And so she agreed, and amazingly it worked, and she got better from her ear trouble. Her pain went, the disease went, and she recovered. But she was a bit ambivalent because she felt somewhere that, you know, he was the great teacher, and somehow, you know, what he'd done had somehow affected her, and her, you know, she'd got something apart from the healing, that maybe he'd done something to her. And she was so fiercely independent, she didn't want to be, you know, in accordance with what Amy was saying, with her whole life's direction, that her father exhorted her, you know, don't depend on any other human being, but seek freely and widely. So Krishnamurti had to convince her that, look, he didn't know how it happened. He just had apparently some ability to heal physical things. But he said, look, you're a very serious person. You listened, and your whole life's in this direction. And you understood that, you know, it's nothing, you know, in a way, it's nothing to do with me. I didn't do it. So she gave up her social activism of this Land Gift movement, the Bhutan movement of Vinoba Bhave, and started to travel the world as a independent spiritual teacher, giving talks and holding meditation and inquiry camps. And she at that stage she left her the Land Gift movement, and she did. She taught worldwide wherever she was invited. She went for decades throughout the Europe, Americas, and India, until it was beginning of the 90s. She decided to remain in India, and her books have been published in a lot of languages. And yet, it's interesting, at the same time, or a bit later on, she re-embraced activism. I mean, not that she'd ever saw it as something separate, we'll get into in a moment. In 1979, she stopped doing these meditation camps and inquiry camps, and started again working for social justice, environmental sustainability, and aiding the poor. And she stopped these global teaching tours for a few years, and again traveled from village to village. She talked with people about local problems, founded centers to educate villagers in agricultural industries, local self-government, democratic citizenship, sanitation, all sorts of things in a very hands-on way, which for her has always been inseparable. So she's had an extraordinary life. Most of the time in India, she would live in a, again, she didn't have any possessions or money. Someone gave, I don't know if it certainly gave her the use of this bungalow in Mount Abu I mentioned earlier, which is a lovely hill station. It's in the desert state of Rajasthan, but a few thousand feet up, which makes it a lot cooler than down on the plains. And it's a beautiful place. And that's where she would be most of the year, except she'd go to the Himalayas, to Dalhousie in summer when it got really too hot, where she was further south. So she had an extraordinary story. Back to you, Amy. I don't know if there's so many things you could say about this.
There really are. But I'd like to talk a little bit about her teachings. But so you get some idea, if you're not familiar with the land grant movement, she was directly responsible for helping to redistribute, you know, million acres of land. This is not a small, it was grassroots, village to village, and working with wealthy land owners and convincing them that this was going to be of benefit for the whole cultural revolution occurring in India around the time of Gandhi. But you can imagine that it would take an extraordinary dedication and humanity to be able to go into these villages, to be able to educate villagers, to inspire them to move out of the very rigid feudal system and to go from being serfs and landless peasants to owning land and being responsible. She set up collectives. So this was really the real trenches of social activism, but on a massive scale. And again, like Chris said, this was without a lot of promotion. It was really word of mouth and village to village. And throughout her life at different periods, she did re-engage at that level of activism. And she said, I'm a lover of life. And as a lover of life, I cannot keep out of any activity of life. If people are hungry for food, my response is to help feed them. If people are hungry for truth, my response is to help them discover it. I make no distinction between serving people who are starving and have no dignity in their physical lives and serving people who are fearful and closed and have no dignity in their mental lives. I love all life.
You know, incidentally, sorry to interrupt there, but I read that she said that in reply to a Western meditation teacher who was inquiring, well, you know, why are you taking up activism again, you know, instead of, you know, meditation, which is obviously deeper, you know, sometimes to our mind and getting at the root of a problem. And this was her reply at that. I thought it was interesting, the context for that remark.
And you can see in her that she was equally at home with people from all different countries, from Poland to Chile to Australia to Holland to Argentina and all over India, the northern states and Gujarat and Uttar Pradesh and all over India. So she was really a woman of the world, you know, a human figure who just transcended limitation and related to the depth of our humanity and what it would be to open us up to a relationship with the world around us that is really profound. What's interesting also about her is that she spoke a little bit similarly to Krishnamurti, a lot about the need for radical revolution. And she talked about revolution in the human being. It was a revolution of the brain. It was a revolution of the human mind. It was a revolution of our way of seeing. She considered spiritual awakening to be that radical revolution. She wanted to change something that was almost physiological, a little bit similar, probably influenced by J. Krishnamurti and the way he would speak about mutation of the brain. In her earlier teachings, she did also speak quite a bit about that. But what she said, what she was looking for, was an engagement with that which is not novel for novelty's sake, but novel in the sense that it's the totality of all that is in expression through an individual in time and space now. And she said there's infinitely more to life, and each passionate being who dares to explore beyond the fragmentary and superficial into the mystery of totality helps all humanity perceive what it is to be fully human. Revolution, total revolution, implies experimenting with the impossible. And when an individual takes a step in the direction of the new, the impossible, the whole human race travels through that individual. She saw wholeness and interconnectedness in such a concrete way that she truly transmitted the sense that our own transformation, our own engagement at the level of consciousness with the very ways that we define reality and relate to truth and relate to the cosmos, that if we individually accessed something novel, something more holistic, something more true, that we took all humanity with us. It wasn't metaphorical for her. It was really the way she saw the totality of the cosmos in the individual as cosmos, cosmos as individual, and the inseparability of all. And you can see that her extraordinary life and the way that she was able to travel the globe and help millions of people change their lives and change the cultural structure of their villages after centuries has to do with this way of not seeing separation, not seeing division, and coming from a fullness and wholeness that was very profound. She wasn't simply looking outwards and seeing lack and wanting to respond. And she wasn't simply looking outwards and seeing mental suffering and agitation and alienation and wanting to fix it. She was rooted in this mysterious sense of completion, of wholeness. And that was what she tried through all her different means to bring into the world and into people's experience. I think she's very relevant right now with so many pressing social and global issues, from the environment to racism to overpopulation. It's very easy to look out and feel overwhelmed by the depth of disunity and suffering and fragmentation. Her response to that was to encourage all of us individually to reach deeply into a silence that's beyond the mind, and from there to access this level of wholeness, and then respond to life and live life as this extraordinary lover of life that she was. She really saw, like, that in the way that if you look out at the night sky and you point your finger anywhere, where you're pointing could become the center. There's no single center of the sky. It can, anywhere you point, because you're in an infinite expanse, you can make that point become the center of all. And that is really how she saw things. She saw things with this real sense that there was no fixed place around which we all revolve, but that all was an expression of the whole and was the center of the whole in itself. And she called that living with totality. Living with totality, it can be a little hard to understand. Well, how do I live with all that is? But if you start to open your mind to what she's pointing to, she's really pointing to the sense of immediacy and the tangibility of the infinite. And that's what she lived from. I start, Chris, to really feel her presence. You know, when we talk about, you can feel her, there's some kind of way that she would transmit this extraordinary lack of affect, immediacy, simplicity. There was no artifice, there were no bells and incense or candles and ritual to get you, you know, you sort of feel like, oh, there were no big fanfare and these religious drums saying, you know, hark, the infinite arrives. But you sit, you know, with her drinking water or tea in her simple veranda, and that is the experience, was this experience of the immediacy of infiniteness and wholeness and silence.
Yeah, it's hard to grasp who she was and what her teaching actually means, because it's not, you know, even with Krishnamurti, you could, you know, he was obviously extraordinary radical, But and he dismissed all forms of teaching, you know, truth's a pathless land. But Vimala had her own way, and it's very hard to pin it down, and this living in totality, because she talked about, and I believe really lived, in this sense of, she called it living without a center or a circumference, a holistic life. And she did, to my mind, have a very rare unity of inner and outer. Her depth was extraordinary, and also obviously her engagement with social activism. But she didn't see them as in balance or doing one then the other and doing some of each to get to her. As you're saying, it's all one thing. It's all coming from a response to life, a response for her. This is a response to that comes out of silence. It comes out of the intelligence of life itself. I mean, she said that compassion is a spontaneous movement of wholeness. It's not a studied decision to help the poor, this is what she said, to be kind to the unfortunate. Compassion has a tremendous momentum that naturally, choicelessly moves us to worthy action. It has the force of intelligence, creativity, and the strength of love. Compassion cannot be cultivated. It derives neither from intellectual conviction nor from emotional reaction. It's simply there when the wholeness of life becomes a fact that is truly lived. And she was, in her being, was a great expression of that. I'm thinking back, I want to say a little bit more, but I think I get more sense of her teaching now when I think of actually meeting her years ago. Because it's this way that when you're with her, the way she listened and the way she held you in her eyes, but it wasn't like I've met meditation masters who can be very intense and very concentrated, you know, and pierce you with their eyes. But her eyes, they were large, they were soft and warm. And so there was something very inviting. She was very kind and soft. And at the same time, there was something extraordinarily strong and fearless. And there's a sort of way in this that I think I see more and more now, and I start to understand her teachings more. It's like the whatever we call the absolute dimension or the non-dual and the human dimensions in her really weren't separate. She was very natural. She was very she could have fun. She was very light, and yet she radiated this stillness of eternity, and yet she was completely present and attentive and very light, and she didn't lecture you. She listened, and she really enjoyed inquiry together. It wasn't her you coming to the master and getting the answers, or undoubtedly she had a lot to share, but it was a genuine meeting of equality. She really saw that like that. She wasn't trying to be artificially humble. I mean, it's an extraordinary person, and yet she emanated incredible natural authority and power. I mean, when I first met her, this is when I'd heard her earlier, but when in the 90s, I went to interview her for What is Enlightenment magazine. And at first she said, oh, happy to have a dialogue, but you know, she doesn't do interviews. I mean, I think I look so crestfallen that she relented and allowed us to publish it, which I'm glad she did. But she her opening statement, because I recorded that interview, she said, I'm a simple person, a human being who has loved life and has seen life as divinity itself. I've lived in love with life, madly in love with the human expression of life as divinity. And you know, I don't think that's an exaggeration in her case, really, because she was really like that. And she had a great precision in the way she would describe the inner journey. She wasn't intellectual or philosophical or not. She was very, she understood. She was very bright and quite erudite, But it was much more that it was deeply experiential. It was subtle and penetrating. So, you know, you felt she was engaged with life. She wasn't removed in any way. And it took me quite a while. I'm still sort of feel I'm trying to get some sense of what she means by meditation, because she did advocate it. She felt that it's very important, although she didn't. She felt that it doesn't really make sense for us to withdraw from life, to be a hermit or live in a cave, because one's missing the all important dimension of relationship. She did feel that for our own development, for our own, if you like, to make us more amenable to silence, to awareness, to the deeper dimensions of our being, that she advocated people should spend 3 to 4 hours in spiritual practice a day. Quite a lot, actually, although that wasn't the main thing for her. That was just as a basis. For her, it seemed meditation was much more life of meditation, that you lived it. It wasn't sitting still and cross-legged or with your eyes closed. And I realize now, even when I would meet with her, that was meditation with her. You felt it with her. She was totally present. Meditation wasn't something, it wasn't something separate from life. It was that deeper dimension that she engaged with all the time and encouraged others to. So that it was more like life became more and more imbued with meditation. And from that, she would feel that a natural intelligence can respond, one's not less and less reacting in a knee-jerk way to all the mind's conditioning. So this is the way she was. So it's a very different sort of way to be. And maybe you'd like to continue, Amy.
Yeah, I'd love to speak a little bit more about her relationship to meditation, because she did advocate meditation practice. She encouraged people to spend even 4 hours a day in meditation. She felt that we needed to work to access these deeper levels of stillness and silence. What's interesting about her is that her teaching of meditation was incredibly subtle, and she really was pointing to what she talked about most was silence. And silence was beyond the mind. And she made subtle distinctions between what concentration is, what attention is, what normally goes under the name of meditation, where we're having an experience and able to reflect on the experience, where the mind is involved. What she was pointing to was what she called silence. And for her, the most precious thing that any individual could do would be to spend time in silence, to spend time really beyond the mind. And she looked at this as all-inclusive attention. And she felt that the true inquiry that came from beyond our preconceived notions was synonymous with this quality of meditation, where there's really one sense of openness and stillness and silence that is not mitigated and mediated by the thought process. It's very, very subtle, and she makes useful distinctions with other types of meditation or way meditation is commonly thought of. She's accepting of other forms of meditation for relaxation, for different types of physical, even she didn't call it stress reduction, but stress reduction. She said those things have their value. She was very inclusive in that way. What she was strong about was confusing different ends and different means. And saying that meditation that involved the thought process was the the same type of meditation that she was pointing to, which was really the silence beyond the mind. So she was very strong about not shortchanging the depths that we could go to. She said, it's only when the awareness of the self as the I being in harmony with the universe subsides of its own that silence comes to life. Till then, there may be quietness, there may be peacefulness, but there's no silence. So the spontaneous cessation of movement on the part of the conditioned human psyche, as well as the unconditioned human psyche, is the content of silence. And the cessation of all movement is the content of silence, she says. She goes on to say, the individual is then no longer an entity that is separate from the rest of life any more than a cloud which floats in the sky is. The cloud has a shape, it has a form, but not a center, nor an identity. So too, the human being in the dimension of silence may have a form, a shape, a body consisting of flesh and bones and nerves and blood, and yet there's no entity in the sense that there is no center. The individual then is like a bubble on the waters of the river of a lake or an ocean. The bubble contains water, is born of water, is made of water, and subsides into water. So the form of such an individual contains that non-dualistic silence, that centerless silence. And when the form subsides, you call it death. The silence, the non-duality, becomes again an organic part of the universal, silence and non-duality. You can feel in what she's saying both the classical metaphors of the bubble on the top of the lake, which is a classical Eastern metaphor, the oneness of all and the emptiness of self-nature. But you also hear in her a very subtle contemporary understanding of mind, of psyche, of conscious and unconscious motives, of cultural conditioning, of the biases, personal biases that we see the world through, all of the ways that we understand the various natures of the human mind and the human personality. And you feel that in her, that she's very much a woman of the contemporary world. And yet what she's pointing to is our infinite nature, and you can feel in her also that she's speaking from a depth of experience, that sense of eternity, and that fearlessness around life and death, that fearlessness and lack of attachment, because there's no identification with a smaller or separate sense of self, that she's living as that silence. So there's form, there's preference, there's moving around the world, and there's relationship. But what's at the heart of all that is this silence. And that was the essence of her meditation practice that she encouraged and taught and really tried to foster in the people who came to her. The other part of her, which may seem in contrast to meditation, is that she really put a tremendous amount of emphasis on human relationships. She put a tremendous amount of emphasis on the quality of our relationship, the quality of our inquiry, the way we are together as people, the kind of selfless kindness and empathy and listening and respect. In her work, when she would travel around the world, she wrote at one point that if she ever felt that the organizing and the publicizing and the arranging of her events was getting in the way of the actual relationships between the individuals in the centers or the individuals in her, she would disband those activities. And she did. She at one point closed her largest centers in Holland and California and stopped traveling there because she felt that the organizing and the sort of being on a more practical or that kind of, I don't mean it in a pejorative sense, but a superficial level of relatedness was getting in the way. And to her, she always protected the essence. That was all that was important to her. And there was an extraordinary fluidity of being. She could move between different ways of being, whether it was public speaking or activist movement or being at her home in Mount Abu, with a seamlessness and a lack of investment. And just, it was like she was always listening to that silence, and that silence was what would motivate her and move her. In her, you also felt that she really was a true spiritual friend. When she connected with you, you felt somehow, even if you never saw her again or never wrote to her again, that if you were to, she would be right there. That her roots reach so deeply into that unity of all of the cosmos that she could immediately connect and relate and respond to the individual in front of her without needing pleasantries or a historical connection. And she was also very polite and pleasant as well. Chris, would you like to?
Yeah, the way she engaged, well, and I experienced that too, the way she engaged with me and everyone, I think is was very beautiful. And she was a spiritual friend, like you when you were speaking. I was feeling that's true. You could be in touch with her and she'd genuinely be happy to continue, because she loved inquiry together. For her, it was the most important. I mean, she said that some type of spiritual community, I mean, she'd mean in a looser sense, was she said, I remember asking her, could this be a vehicle for development? And she said more strongly, no, this is the only one, she says. And she feels that it's there's too much emphasis, particularly in India, that's been on physical isolation and withdrawals, overemphasized that the retreats are useful and a part of education, but not a dimension to live in. So for her, this sort of active inquiry with spiritual friends was was really the joy of life. And she makes very interesting distinctions between a teacher, a master, and a guru, and is very good at being aware of all the subtle ways that, and not so subtle sometimes, that people can get caught up with spiritual authorities. And with her, she really didn't do that. And yet she wasn't as Krishnamurti, who was more extreme in a way of saying, I'm just a human being, just sharing, I'm not nothing special, he would say. Obviously, although thousands of people had come to see him, so he was very special, obviously. Vimala felt that there was a real mutual enrichment between what she called the inquirer and the person who perhaps understands more, the understander. So between the student and the teacher. But for her, it's much more about being a friend than this, the student, or she would call the shisha in the way she referred to it, is really all about a life of inquiry where both benefit, because she would say when someone comes to see her, she would be lit up. It would make her feel ecstatic to converse with someone genuine who wants to go into something together. That it wasn't that this was the real joy and essence of life itself. So that was her understanding of being a teacher, not in the traditional sense, but she was really sharing something, and she loved to do that with other people. I mean, she said, let me live. This is what she said to me when I asked her about teachers. She said, let me live as an invisible teacher, not a master, but a teacher. I've been exploring a dimension of a relationship between the inquirer and the enlightened one on the basis of equality. It's an exploration and a revolutionary relationship. All my life, it's been a sharing, like members of a spiritual family, on the basis of friendship and cooperation. So she has a lot to say on this subject, as she does on many others. It's worth reading her. So we're really approaching the end of this. I mean, maybe we should say a little bit about, I mean, what we can learn from her, because she's not so well known, and it's a shame she isn't better known, really, that more of her books aren't more available, because you pick up any of her books and they're quite extraordinary, because you've got such a vulnerable, humble, and yet deeply wise human being sharing her experience that I certainly find it more and more. I was saying to Amy, I want to actually have a book by my bedside, one of her books, and just read a piece. I find it incredibly pertinent, perhaps because she so much embodied action and inner inquiry in a way that, as she felt, that everyone needed to do in our times. And she was someone who really brought the teachings of the East to the West in such a human and accessible way. There's a lot she has to give, and she had a lot about how to actually live life, because it wasn't just giving these, you know, talks she went around. She held camps and in spiritual inquiry sessions, and as we said, was deeply engaged in social action. But she had lots of pointers of how to live this life of meditation, how to more deeply engage with silence and come from that place about diet, about sleep, about exercise. I mean, everything, because she saw everything as coming from the same place, cooking and eating. She would talk of meditation as in as you are cooking, as a natural response of the body on the physical level to what's needed, and therefore eating and cooking the right things. Well, I mean, it's extraordinarily holistic. Over to you, Amy.
I was just reflecting on, you know, the volumes of her work and how rare it is to come across them. And I want to encourage everyone to pick up anything of hers and spend time with it. What she inspires is not somebody to become like her, and not somebody to even engage in silence and discovery in the way that she did. What she really inspires is a trust and respect and passion for our own spiritual yearning and for the focus of spiritual discovery, and for this sheer joy and delight of having friendships, having relationships with all kinds of people that are really rooted in the sense of what she called silence and what I would call love with a capital L, that what she inspires in us is to find that interest and love of subtlety and depth, and to pursue it, and to pursue it without any kind of rigidity or limitation or sense that it has to appear in a certain way, and it has to have an activist component, it has to have a meditation component, it has to have this component or that component. Just pursue it in our own lives as our lives are now. Maybe we are parents of young children. Maybe we are business people. Maybe we are educators. Go to that depth of inquiry so that you can discover, as she said, a way of understanding ourselves as one with that silence, as one with that eternity, in different form and with different life possibility. And through that, you know, we will start to undergo what she called a revolution of the mind. I'd like to end with one more passage from her. I love her own words so much. I think the best we can do is be left with those. She said, "The vast intelligence that orders the cosmos is available to all. The beauty of life, the wonder of living, is that we share creativity, intelligence, and unlimited potential with the rest of the cosmos. If the universe is vast and mysterious, we are vast and mysterious. If it contains innumerable creative energies, we contain innumerable creative energies. If it has healing energies, we also have healing energies. To realize that we're not simply physical beings on a material planet, but that we are whole beings, each a miniature cosmos, each related to all of life in intimate, profound ways, should radically transform how we perceive ourselves, our environments, our social problems. Nothing can ever be isolated from wholeness."